Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Aerospace Advantage. I am John Baum, and it is my honor to continue our focus on Desert Storm. As we discussed in our last episode, this was a pivotal conflict that revolutionized the way in which we think about warfare. We need to embrace the lessons from this conflict. They are going to prove very important as we look to future challenges. Now, as you may recall, last time we spoke with General Mike Lowe, Lieutenant General Dave Deptula, and Colonel John Warden about how they laid the foundation for the air campaign that would define the war. Today, we're going to move along the historic timeline and go in theater with the top air commander who ran the air war, General Chuck Horner. Joining me today, once again, as co-host, is Colonel Rich Reynolds.
Thanks, Lick. To set the stage for your listeners, I think it might be useful to quickly remind them of the enormous significance of what Colonel John Warden and his ad hoc team, that included a young, newly promoted Lieutenant Colonel David Deptula, did in the basement of the Pentagon. There they created Instant Thunder, an early air power response to Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. That plan, if not forcefully supported by General Lowe, the Air Force Vice Chief of Staff at the time, would surely have died unnoticed and unheralded, never reaching the eager ears of General Norman Schwarzkopf, CENTCOM's commander, who at the time was desperately searching for a strategic option to counter Iraqi aggression in the Gulf. That work, by so few, with no mandate or charter, laid the groundwork for everything that was to come next and aided immeasurably to the work that CENTCOM Air Component Commander, our new guest, Lieutenant General Chuck Horner, and his forces did in theater. General Deptula, am I missing anything here?
Well, Rich, there's certainly a lot more details here, but essentially you've got it. It was really a busy few weeks, and quite unexpectedly, I found myself in Saudi Arabia racing to flesh out an executable plan for General Horner.
Now, without further ado, it is my pleasure to introduce General Chuck Horner. He is an air power legend, a Vietnam F-105 Thud pilot, a key actor who helped rebuild the Air Force coming out of that war, and the lead air commander for Desert Storm. Sir, as I recall, early after Saddam's invasion, we had a bare minimum force in theater. We had some F-15s that have just been rushed over to Saudi Arabia and helped deter Saddam from any further aggression. And can you describe how you requested the follow-on forces and what drove the types of capabilities and the numbers?
Well, first of all, we're planning to do an exercise at Eglin, which would define what forces we'd have and what we could use. And at that time, forces were allotted to the unified commanders. So I could only pick those forces that were allotted to me. And so I had Langley, Myrtle Beach, Shaw, and England all on alert. I could immediately send those forces once King Fahd invited us, and I was in Jeddah. So I said, launch. And so the plan there was to take the F-15s and co-locate them with the Saudi F-15s because we needed immediate air defense. We didn't know whether Iraq was coming south or not. The A-10s we put up and co-located in Dahran. The reason we did that is so they could attack a leading edge of an invasion force. Now, the F-15s and the A-10s in Dahran area were there also. In case we were being overrun, we could evacuate them directly into Bahrain and then blow the causeway. Then the other forces I had assigned were the Cannon F-111s. Well, I was over in Jeddah, and Schwarzkopf said, I'm going to go back and push the forces forward. Chuck, you stay here and defend Saudi Arabia with two armored car companies up on the border. That was it. So if they decided to come south, all we could do is harass them. We couldn't stop them. So then I moved up to be CENTCOM forward. So I was in charge of bedding down all the forces coming in. And Schwarzkopf was in charge of sending forces forward. And that's when Checkmate got involved and said, here's the forces you should have. And that was very helpful.
Hey, thanks for that, General Horner. And great to see you again. While bedding down those forces, you also had to focus on planning. Could you inform our audience a bit and talk about the planning effort, both from a defensive and offensive perspective, and then give us some insights on how you dealt with General Schwarzkopf and the other service component commanders?
First of all, planning. Back in November of 89, Schwarzkopf took command. He came up to Shaw to see me. And he said, Chuck, they're fixing to shut down CENTCOM because then our tasking was to defeat the Russian invasion to get to a warm water port. That's how CENTCOM got started. And he says, so we have to have either another enemy or we're out of business. I think that Iraq came out of the Iran-Iraq war deep in debt, powerful in military. So he said, we need to take a look at if Iraq comes south to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf Arab states, because Iraq was starting to cause a lot of problems. So I started thinking about that back in November, because that was brand new tasking. And so in December or January of the next year, I held a conference down at Shaw, and I brought in all the experts on Iraq, on the Middle East, from State Department, from RAND, from and all the military. So I looked at what they provided me. And so I built a briefing that says, here's what we do if we have to go to war. And I went to see Schwarzkopf. Well, I addressed things like the Scud. So before I ever went there, I always was very upfront with even people who disagreed with me. In this case, the Army, about the control of the Patriot. And the only capability they had was Patriot anti-ballistic missile. So I went to Yosaka and said, look, I want to control the Patriots and I want to see where they go. You're not going to get an attack from the enemy because, first of all, the Saudis have missiles, SAMs. And second of all, Iraq ain't going to get into Saudi Arabia airspace because we're all very strong air-to-air. And he agreed readily, never issue. And then the other thing is, in Vietnam, we used to sit alert for TAS, primarily in Laos, where the Air America guys were working. And we'd go on a CAS alert, ground alert, for 2 hours. At the end of 2 hours, they'd launch us to go bomb trees. And I said, that's a total waste. We could have been doing some good. So I went to Schwarzkopf and he says, I'm not going to do any ground alert CAS. I'm not going to do any airborne alert CAS. But I am going to have fighters over the enemy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I'll put in place a command and control network, which we already had, that can divert any of those flights onto the Iraqis if needed, if our ground forces need it. We call that push CAS. In other words, we push the force that was already overhead onto a CAS target rather than its pre-plant target. And he agreed. But I knew there were going to be issues when we got together. When Schwarzkopf first came to see me, we got talking. He says, George Crist, my predecessor, had you as his Joint Force Air Component Commander. Well, I will continue to do that. I said, thank you. Now I said, who's the Ground Component Commander? He thought and he said, well, I guess I will be. And then I said to him, well, if that's the case, understand, I'm going to talk to you in a way you don't like from time to time, because we both owe it to our overall commander, which also happens to be you, to give them the best advice so they can fight the war in the best way. And he says, I accept that. The first Navy component we had there was surface warfare and kind of imperial. And he wanted to institute the thing called root packages. Root packages was the way we divided North Vietnam into geographic cells, so that we didn't have to work together. The Navy could do whatever they wanted to, and the Air Force could do whatever they wanted to. Well, it was absolute bullshit. I told the Navy guy when he came to me with the root package thing, I said, I'll resign before I'll agree to that. And I says, if you'd been in Vietnam, you'd understand. And then he got taken away, fortunately, and replaced with a guy named Stan Arthur, who had flown over North Vietnam in the A-4s. And he readily agreed to that we'd not have route packages. So that solved that problem. Had a little problem with the Marine Corps, not Walt Boomer. But 2 years before that, we'd done an exercise out at March Field, and the Marine Corps had fought me being this control of the air, their aircraft. And also, they wanted their own airspace. And so I took a helicopter down to 29 Palms, where their headquarters was, and Phil Monahan, who was the head Marine, and I, and his airman, Royal Moore, we're in this TACC of the Marine Corps, and we started to discuss the issues, and it involved things like poking each other in the chest, sweat running down our faces from anger, using immoderate language, which I'm not known for. And as a result, I flew back up And that night, George Chris, the Marine, Sink, called me into, after the meeting, he called Phil and me into his trailer. We're there, and he says, okay, Phil, it says here that the unified commander, that's me, can designate somebody to be the Joint Force Air Component Commander. And he says, I've decided to do that. It'll be Chuck Horner. And he says, do you have any comment? And Phil said, no. Now, Phil and I and Yosak and Colin Powell had gone to the same class at Air War College. So we walked outside, and I said, Phil, did Al Gray put you up to this? Al was a head Marine. And he said, no, Royal Moore did. And I said, well, I hope there's no hard feelings. He says, there isn't. So then show up in Desert Storm, Royal Moore's still the air wing commander. And so once again, he goes to his boss, who's Walt Boomer, brand new commander, and says, we need to get control of the air. And Boomer says, I ain't touching this one with a 10-foot pole. And so that was the end of that. The Marines were fully taken care of and fully represented. It just, they weren't in charge.
Yeah, General Horner, let me interrupt you there and just tell us a short war story that reflects the perspective of General Moore. When General Glossin and I flew to Bahrain on the 30th of August in 1990 to brief Admiral Maws and General Moore on the air campaign plan, General Moore, I recall, grabbed me outside the Admiral's wardroom and said to me, quote, the first bomb that falls in Iraq should only be after the first Marine crosses the line with his bayonet fixed, unquote. Okay, back to you.
The one thing that would best characterize the American commanders, generals, was absolute cooperation, absolute trust in one another. The only people we had any trouble with at all, it was the some of the Army lower commanders resented the fact that the air was going to be in the leadership of this war. The way I handled Schwarzkopf was I was always honest with him, and I never talked to him or said anything to him. I wouldn't even tell him good morning in public. I could go into his office, close the door, and say, you're the dumbest general I've ever seen. He'd say, oh, why do you say that? And I tell him, he says, well, it's not me. I know who did it, and I'll get that taken care of. And so he was really good, but he was very nervous about being tied into a position in public until he had a chance to think it through. So he lost his temper one time with me, and that's Dave was present. And I just stayed calm and took him up to his office and had Buster come in and show him what he'd been briefed that he was really revolting against. And he said to me something I found very humorous. He says, you have no idea the pressure I'm under. And I thought, you got to be shitting me. We were all under extreme pressure. And that's the nature of war. But we actually all got along very, very well.
Well, sir, up to this point, we've focused a lot on the U.S. forces and the U.S. commanders. But what about the international factor? And, you know, really curious as to what your relationships were like and the challenges working with the other coalition partners.
Well, I was worried about that because if you read the history, coalition is harder to fight than the war. Working together becomes very difficult. We did have some problems. One problem we had was the French Secretary of Defense or Minister of Defense guy didn't like Americans and he liked Iraqis because he sold them a lot of equipment. And so he was causing problems like, for example, the French Air Force were not allowed to bed down with us. Well, they couldn't get the ATO without us. So they had to have somebody there, American. And he essentially was fired by the Prime Minister. The Brits were wonderful, but the trouble is their MOD and their Whitehall, their State Department, would issue these directives. And Paddy Hine was a chief air marshal for Britain. He would take these very carefully and put them in his desk. And we also had an American general there, Carl Franklin, who helped him in this process. So I never heard from the British. And their general they had, the first one they had, was an idiot. The second one was really a good guy, Bill Ratton, and he later pinned on his fourth star. We are concerned about the Arab, particularly the Saudi hosts, because of the differences in culture and things of this nature. And so I got on the phone with General Schwarzkopf, and we discussed this, And we decided the answer was to have a co-commander who would be an Arab. And the ideal guy to do that was Khalid bin Sultan, because he was the MOD's son. He was educated widely in America and in England. And he understood the Western culture just as probably far more than we did the Arab culture. But nonetheless, the problem we had was how to get him appointed, because doing so would generate a lot of jealousy among other Arab nations and other Arab leaders. What he had to do is promise that he would immediately leave the service after the war was over, and he did. We really had no problem with the other countries, but we also did something that we didn't do in Vietnam. We said, we're here to help. We have deep respect for your views, and we're not going to tell you what to do. We're going to ask you what you want to do. And so answer is this: if you respect people, they respect the fact that America is powerful, the fact that America judgment is generally quite good, and that we really know how to fight wars. And so I never had a problem with any of the coalition friends.
Well, sir, you did mention Vietnam in that answer. And can you talk about how the shadow of Vietnam played on your influence and how you thought about executing this war?
It influenced all of us, all of the American generals that have been in Vietnam. We weren't going to make those same mistakes again. For example, we are not going to be in charge. We'll be there to help, lead, but we're not going to be in charge. We're blessed, fortunately, at the political level of our country. George Bush never tried to tell us how to fight the war. He only gave us two things of goals. One is liberate occupied Kuwait, but we had to do that quietly, because we were trying our best to do it through diplomacy. And second of all, he was worried about the loss of life. And when I heard it, I briefed him in Camp David. When I heard him say that, I said, well, of course, you're worried about American lives. And I realized, no, we're going to fight as a coalition. And he told us, you're going to fight as a coalition. So then I said, well, he means coalition life. And then the more he asked questions, the more I realized he meant all life, enemy and friendlies. And that drove heavily our targeting. We didn't target Iraqi soldiers. We targeted their means to inflict damage on our people, tanks, artillery, weapons of mass destruction, those kinds of things.
Well, sir, what was the impact of new technologies like stealth and precision-guided munitions?
Revolutionary, but I'll let Depp Tula answer it since he's written a book about it.
Well, thanks, sir. I think that the best way to get across the impact of stealth and precision is with an example. In World War II, it took up to 1,000 bombers with 10 men each, dropping 9,000 to 10,000 bombs to destroy just one target. Now, the reason for those huge numbers is that they were necessary to compensate for the lack of accuracy of our weapon systems back then.
Back then, on average, half the bombs dropped landed outside a half a mile from the target. Now fast forward to Desert Storm, the F-117s, the F-111Es, and the F-15s, they could drop multiple laser-guided bombs, each with an accuracy of less than 10 feet. So that dramatically reduced the number of aircraft required to kill a target, and it allowed us to expand the number of targets that could be hit with a given number of aircraft. Now, I don't believe as many people are as familiar with the leverage that stealth demonstrated in the first Gulf War. So let me offer one more example that involves the first non-stealthy attack on one target with three aim points in the Basra area. And the target was the Shaiba airfield, to be exact. The attack package consisted of four Navy A-6s dropping bombs, along with four Saudi Tornado bomb droppers, five Marine EA-6Bs jamming the acquisition radars, four Air Force F-4Gs taking out SA-6 surface-to-air missile systems, 17 F-18s targeting SA-2s, and then four F-18s as mid-cap, plus three drones to bring up the enemy radars. Now, if you do the math, that's 41 aircraft eight of them dropping bombs on one target. At about the same time, I fragged 20 F-117s, all 20 dropping bombs on 38 aim points at 28 different targets. That's less than half the aircraft hitting over 1,200% of the target base. So if you look at that from a leverage standpoint, that equates to essentially 19 non-stealth aircraft to accomplish the effect of one stealth aircraft in this particular example. So what you saw was the combination of stealth, precision, and our effects-based targeting strategy is what allowed us to strike targets across the entirety of Iraq simultaneously that first night and every night thereafter of Desert Storm.
Well, General Deptula, thanks for that insight. General Horner, what political issues came into play and how did you manage those challenges?
I really didn't have a problem with political issues from our government like we did in Vietnam, where we had the Secretary of Defense picking the targets and giving us measures of merits and things like that. In this case, we were allowed to operate as best we could. We had the trust of us, President and the SecDef, to do the things right. I've already talked about the French and the English and the Saudis and the Arab countries. But quite frankly, it was a very smooth operation with regard to the political issues. We did shoot down two Iraqis over Iran. We shouldn't have been there. We knew that. So unlike Vietnam, where we changed the shoot down point or lied about what we'd done, I immediately called Schwarzkopf, and I know he called Washington immediately. And so after the war, I was on a podium with Secretary Cheney, and I said, "Sir, did you hear us about shooting down those two Iraqis over Iran?" He says, "Yeah." He said, "I wish you hadn't done that." And I said, "So do I, but nonetheless, it happened. We missed the stop sign." And I said, "Did you get any paperwork on that?" And he says, "As a matter of fact, I got a staff summary sheet that laid out some things you could do so it wouldn't happen again." And I remember I wrote on it, "They'll know what to do in theater and send it back." Now that was it. Now, the really funny thing is the Iranian air defense system came up on the air after the next day after we did this and said, "If you see any Americans flying over our country, don't shoot. They're just chasing Iraqis." So incredible. Sometimes the political thing needs to be on your side. And I did it because my generals never stood up for me in Vietnam. Okay.
Well, all right. At this point, gentlemen, can you please walk us through the first day of the air campaign? Like, you know, talk about what the highlights were. What were you doing? Because, you know, most Americans watch this on CNN and you were able to see it and observe it up close. So we'll start with you, General Horner.
Quite frankly, my concern was I was unsure. I shouldn't have been. As General Creech pointed out after the war, about if stealth really worked, because we really hadn't been in a tough war with it. We dropped some bombs in Panama where there were no real air defense. So I said, you know, I have the opportunity to be the first general to lose an entire fleet of aircraft in the opening days of the war, because the defenses they went into were very tough. And as it turned out, it worked. And so that allayed my really one concern. The other thing I had concern about was we planned the first 2.5 days of the war in detail, high detail. And I knew that if we planned beyond that, we'd become a slave to that plan. And that's not good in war, because war is a game of cat and mouse and changing situations and environments. I knew that our efficiency would fall off drastically on the third day. But I accepted that because I wanted people who were agile, who could think, who were not caught up in what they'd thought about previously. And quite frankly, building an ATO is a very arduous process that most people don't understand or comprehend. Okay, Dave, you got it. First day of the war.
Yes, sir. Well, from my perspective, the first 24 hours were filled with anticipation. You know, as General Horner spoke to about how that initial attack would unfold, would it work overall? He mentioned this was the first full-scale use of stealth. How is it going to perform? How is our suppression of enemy air defenses going to work? So, you know, about a half an hour before it kicked off with that first bomb, I walked down the hall from the black hole to the then Tactical Air Control Center, where General Horner and all the leadership had gathered for the opening moments, because that would be key to answering those questions. Now, little known to many, even those in the Tactical Air Control Center were the specific targets, and one of them was very key. We called it the AT&T building because its formal name simply wouldn't fit on the master attack plan. Turns out AT&T had nothing to do with it. But a majority of all the telecommunications that went into and out of Baghdad went through this building because that allowed the Saddam regime to monitor those communications. It happened to be the first target to be hit by F-117s in Baghdad, and it turned out to provide our first effects-based battle damage assessment from the war. General Horner had a TV in his office up on the third floor of the Royal Saudi Air Force headquarters building where we were working, and he sent Lieutenant Colonel Buck Rogers up to his office to watch CNN because he knew that the CNN feed went through this building. So at the designated time on target, Buck called General Horner and told him that CNN had gone off the air. And what erupted was a small cheer among those of us huddled around General Horner, understanding just what that meant. Our plan worked, stealth worked, and we were on our way to a great success. Now, right after that, I went back to the planning cell, passed on the great news to the folks in there, and then we turned our attention to anticipating the battle damage assessment from the first wave of the attacks, because just like General Horner said, we know the plan is going to change, and we need to be able to plan appropriately for those follow-on attacks. There was also a huge concern about the survivability of the force and the losses that we would take. So many hours later, when the last F-111 landed, we were all ecstatic when finally hearing that no aircraft were lost. Now, later it turned out that we actually lost one F-18, unfortunately. But the bottom line on the planning effort is we had all kinds of challenges with getting battle damage assessment, and we had to devise our own feedback systems that we used for the rest of the war. But that's a story for another day.
So, General Horner, it's now been 30 years since Desert Storm. Really wonder, what are your key takeaways and what have defense leaders forgotten from this experience that should be highlighted in your view?
Well, the first lesson was the President of the United States, who gave us a political objective or a goal for the war that was achievable with military force. We haven't had that since then, other than to coerce the Afghanis to quit hosting Al-Qaeda, and they really never quit, but they said they would. But all the wars we fought since then, we've forgotten the idea that you better know you can do the job with military force before you start fighting and killing people. Because war's horrible. I think the second thing is, the closer you are to the battle, the more you understand what's going on. I would purposely sit down in the TACC, our headquarters, our op center, and let what's going on wash over me. I'd hear phone calls. I'd see shoot downs. I'd see all the things that are involved in the combat operations. And that gave me a feeling for how things are going and what we needed to do next. Bill Creech is the guy that taught us decentralized decisions and execution. And in my case, it was very painful, his lessons. But nonetheless, it paid off. When you ran a base under Creech, you were in charge. And if the staff didn't like the way you were spending your money, that was their problem, because Creech would never say a thing to you. But if you're ever not combat ready, he'd fire you. So a lot of the things you saw in Desert Storm were from Bill Creech, his emphasis on readiness, his emphasis on the ability to deploy quickly, and the ability to have the logistics buildup we had in our pre-po munitions. That was all Creech. In fact, he told the Saudis they needed to build those bases they built that we fell in on. It was Crete. He said, he visited Saudi Arabia, and he says, they're sitting on Fort Knox with a shotgun. He said, they need to do something. But things, when anytime you have senior leaders making decisions, you've got problems. The way we set it up was we had a flat organization. We set it up with the TACC telling all the airmen what needed to be done, and then depending on them to use their judgments once they were over the target, whether to do it or not. And, of course, that was just the opposite of Vietnam, where you were in trouble. So what you did is you lied. And I never wanted to put another airman in a position of having to tell a lie because of punitive response.
Well, General Horner and General Deptula, thank you both so much for your insight and time today. It has truly been an honor.
No, bullshit.
Yeah, let me add my thanks for the very, very insightful time. Really awesome, and appreciate you.
And make sure that you keep the Missile Institute doing what it's doing, because we don't have anybody really understanding how air powers change nature of warfare. They still want to fight the Civil War, walk the battlefields. And the Navy just sails off because they don't want to have anything to do with the Army. And the Army thinks that war is Army fighting Army. They have no idea about what war has become. They're finding out rapidly, but they refuse to learn, many of them. The best Army generals are the ones that served in Korea, because they absolutely survive through air power. Otherwise, they're swimming.
Yes, sir. We'll do our best.
Yes. Slick, to help put all of this in context, we've asked Dr. Dick Hallion, a distinguished former historian of the United States Air Force and a prolific author whose many works include Rolling Thunder and Storm Over Iraq, to wrap up this episode with us. Dick, thanks so much for being here today.
Rich, Slick, it's just great to be part of this. History is very perishable, as we see today, and that's why I think it's critically important that we have sessions like this.
Well, absolutely, and Dr. Hallion, I have to say, we've really embarked on an incredible journey, hearing all of these memories from all of the key figures. It's just been an incredible, incredible experience for me, I can tell you, as somebody who loves air power and as an airman. But from your perspective, you have studied history extensively, and you wrote one of the first books on Desert Storm. If you had to rack and stack things regarding that air campaign, how would you break it down when it comes to the main takeaways regarding strategy, operational concepts, technology, and the leadership?
I think the first thing I'd say is it validated global reach, global power, the strategic planning structure that Secretary of the Air Force Don Rice had put in place in June 1990, which capitalized basically on the speed, range, flexibility, precision, and lethality of air power. It was very controversial at the time, and we almost needed a test case, and the test case really proved to be Saddam's invasion of Kuwait. The idea of using air power as the dominant striking force, the dominant force of response, was very controversial. I'll never forget at that time, a senior Air Force executive, literally an individual on the air staff, actually confronted me at one point and said, I hope you're not one of those people who thinks that air power is going to play an influential role in this war. And I think that speaks the conventional mindset that many people had at the time. But looking at the war and what it validated, I think it also validated the Joint Force Air Component Commander as the air commander and air boss. Now, that was dependent to a great degree on the personal relationship that Chuck Horner had struck with Norman Schwarzkopf. And that, I think, is a tribute to Schwarzkopf as well. But the JFAC, of course, became a standard element of air campaign planning from that point onwards, as did the idea of what we now call the Combined Air Operations Center. From the operational concept side, certainly it validated stealth, precision attack, air mobility, and the idea of the tanker bridge. We had always considered that important, but when you're taking a look at how rapidly we had to move things into the Gulf and the importance of tanking for that, absolutely critical. The other point was, I think it showed the importance of having a theater commander who has faith in his air commander and who does not meddle within the functionings of the air war on a petty basis. He gives orders, he gives direction, and lets the air commander do the job. And then, of course, I think finally, we can't forget training. Slick, you have been there. Rich, you have been there. Training was all important. And what was remarkable was when you were taking a look at the Air Force and Navy and NATO airmen and Marine airmen that came out of that conflict, in retrospect, they all said that actually the combat operations had been easier than the training they had experienced. And I think that that really reflected well on the training and simulation that had gone into preparation for that war.
That's, I think, a wonderful summation of what things happened. Dick, if stealth was so important in Desert Storm, then why is just 20% of the fighter fleet and 13% of the bomber fleet stealthy today? Go ahead.
I think on the stealth question, stealth was a genuine revolution in air warfare in terms of the capabilities it offered. It was as important as the turbojet engine, the invention of the swept wing, things like that. I do not envision now and in the future a time when we will turn our back on stealth. Stealth is an integral part of aerospace design now across many, many different areas. It's just that it's taken us longer to get there.
Dick, if the Air Force, with our guests General Lowe, General Horner, and then Lieutenant Colonel Deptula and Colonel John Warden, got it so right in Desert Storm, but drifted so badly astray 10 years later in Afghanistan and Iraq, whose fault is that?
I think that what happened is we, to a large degree, ignored the success that we had in the Gulf, and we ignored the British and French experience with air control. We didn't think what the problems are when you go for long-term occupation. We got it wrong in Mogadishu. We got it wrong in Tora Bora after 9/11. And the price for that was paid by an awful lot of young Americans, as my wife and I used to see, unfortunately, at Walter Reed on a regular basis. We forgot to figure out what the end state should be. You should never go into a conflict unless you understand what the end state is that you're actually trying to achieve. And so what happened ultimately is that we solved the enemy's targeting strategy problem. We put our forces within easy reach of the enemy. We negated our own technical advantage. I'll never forget, shortly after the initial air campaign in Afghanistan, where a Taliban leader who was captured said, "It would have been beautiful if you came by land, because then we could have embraced you and fought you, and we could have increased this pain. But instead, you came by air." Well, we neglected that over the following months. We got trapped into incrementalism. We got trapped into this idea of occupation. And that is a fatal mistake that we made, and we're backing away from it now, but it's been a very, very pricey era.
Yes, I see your points, but I think also, in addition, could you comment on the fact that certain victory was the Army's response to the success of the Desert Storm, and nobody on our side that we could really see, the air power proponents, including yourself, didn't appear to be a strong enough push, a pushback against certain victory and against the idea that air land battle had done all this and the 100-hour war was far more important than what the air power did.
When people have to cast a war in terms of an expression like 100-hour war, it indicates already, I think, that they're on the defensive. When you take a look at the war, of course, was a joint force war. There was a role there for every military service, and all military services, to the best of their abilities, performed very, very well. But undeniably, what you had was a rebelling against the notion that there was a major change in the way warfare was being conducted itself. The 20th century was a century of three-dimensional war, war from above the surface, war from below the surface of the ocean. And basically, Desert Storm was the apotheosis of that. It really culminated in showing that from that point on, big investment in land warfare items, the Crusader artillery system, that took two airplanes to fly one cannon and its loader into a crisis region, big investments in heavy, expensive tanks, things like that, those were going away. The future was an aerospace future. And, you know, actually, if we take a look at that, it gets to this whole idea of competing visions of war. And after the war, it's very interesting to take a look in a doctrinal sense what happened in China and what happened in Russia and what happened in the NATO nations. They picked up on these things. They revised their doctrines to really accommodate the air-centric strategy and teachings that had been promulgated by our experience in Desert Storm. And if you take a look at it today, basically we see the same thing. You know, we see stealth as pervasive across the nations, including rising peers and potentially some threats. We see strategies that are much more based on using an aerospace solution, battlefield rocket artillery, cruise missiles, hypersonic weaponry, things like this. The challenge for us today is not to get so locked in some of these previous archaic fights between air and land and sea that we miss how we have to build on our particular capabilities in AI and cyber, which are emerging these days, to inform those and so that we continue this military revolution that really is, in my view, an unfolding revolution in military affairs. When you take the fourth largest army and you trash it in 43 days so that at the end of that time, it's not the world's fourth largest army, it's the fourth largest army in Iraq. Obviously, there's been a revolution in capabilities that's enabled you to reach that point.
And yet we still have someone like Slick who drops bombs at the behest of the ground commander, and he's not allowed to release anything without it when he drives into Afghanistan. That's the irony of all of this.
The irony is that history, of course, is the working of people over time. And so therefore, the people factor will always be the dominant one. And as we saw at Tora Bora, when you had a ground commander who did not appreciate air power, you had basically, you nearly came close to having the same result you had at Kazarin in 1943. It is understandable that ground commanders want to have total control of the air above them. But the problem is they always waste that advantage on the short distance, short-term fight. They never see the value of air in the strategic picture, the fact that an airplane that may be out of sight to them is doing very good things to them because it's attacking command and control. It's undertaking an interdiction strike. It's doing something else that has profound significance for them. Much rather, they'd like to see that aircraft simply blowing things up in front of them. And worse, they'd like to control it and micromanage it. And the mechanics and the capabilities we now have in broad spectrum command and control mean that you can get that kind of influence, and you can get it from the political world back in CONUS as well.
You know, you're painting a really broad brush concept here, and to not sound like zealots for only air power under that vein, but, you know, obviously, you know, airmen were very, very proud of the air campaign, and then, of course, ground forces would argue that it all came down to the last 100 hours of the war that they were, you know, rolling into Kuwait. But can you provide some context on how these inter-service rivalries, you know, have set us up for the future going forward?
The problem is that these kind of rivalries, which should actually serve a very good purpose, because it's important for people who are service members to be proud of their service and to understand what their service contributes to national defense. These rivalries have carried to an extreme, get people to think that the only solution is a particular service-centric solution, an Army solution, an Air Force solution, a Marine solution, a Navy solution, whatever it is. Actually, it's a little bit like what Chuck Horner reflected on in a discussion I had with him a while back, where he was talking about coalition airmen. There were all these problems with the coalition's political and national leadership and working together. But at the airman-to-airman level, things worked pretty well. If you take a look at Desert Storm as it unfolded, basically, the airmen of the service has worked together and worked work around issues and things like this. So actually, at that level, things worked very, very well. We've seen this in previous wars. You saw it in World War II. You saw it in Korea, Vietnam, certainly. where the further away people are from the combat theater, the more intensive the rivalries, the service rivalries become, whereas in theater, they tend to be worked out. And we have to make certain that that's the model of effectiveness as we move forward, and efficiency, not the model of battles within the Beltway and within the Pentagon.
Well, with that, Rich, that brings us to the end of this episode. And I really want to thank you for engaging in these conversations. Your perspectives and insights are second to none.
Well, thank you, Slick. It's hard to believe that more than 30 years have passed since Air Power's vindication in Desert Storm, but here we are. The opportunity to talk with these key players who planned and executed the greatest, most successful air campaign in history has been a privilege and an honor for me. My respect for all of these people is immense and enduring. There is still much to be learned from these airmen, especially for those who are carrying the fight in today's Air Force. People and ideas matter, I think, more than ever.
Rich, I totally agree. And in the next episode of the Aerospace Advantage podcast, we will have an exclusive discussion with General Jay Raymond, the first Chief of Space Operations, the top leader of the United States Space Force. If you like what you've heard today, please subscribe, like, and follow the Aerospace Advantage podcast. And as always, you can join in the conversation by following the Mitchell Institute on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, or LinkedIn, or by visiting us at mitchellaerospacepower.org. Thank you for listening. Fly safe and check six.